And good evening. A new initiative to combat anti-Semitism in Brooklyn and the United States on the road to war with Iran inside of Iraq. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Monday, December 30th, 2019. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi condemned U.S. airstrikes on bases of Iranian-backed Iraqi militia today. It's a move that could plunge Iraq further into the heart of a proxy conflict between the United States and Iran. The U.S. military carried out airstrikes on Sunday against the Kataib Hezbollah militia. Officials say it's a response to the killing of a U.S. civilian contractor in a rocket attack on an Iraqi military base. At least 25 militia fighters were killed and 55 wounded. Iraq's government opposed the attack and has summoned the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad. The strikes come at a time when thousands of Iraqis have been taking to the streets. The protests in part have condemned militias and their Iranian patrons, which support Iraqi President Abdul Mahdi's government. But both Iran and the militias have threatened reprisals against the United States. After flying to Mar-a-Lago to meet President Trump on Saturday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, and Joint Chief of Staff Head Mark Milley, General Mark Milley, held a brief news conference.
Good evening. Myself, Secretary Esper, Chairman Joint Chief of Staff Milley came here to Florida today to brief the President on the activities that have taken place in the Middle East over the course of the last 72 hours. I will leave to Secretary Esper to talk about the military activity, but I want to put it in the context of our policy with respect to the Islamic Republic of Iran. The attacks that took place against an Iraqi facility threatened American forces. This has been going on now for weeks and weeks and weeks. This wasn't the first set of attacks against this particular Iraqi facility and others where there are American lives at risk. And today, what we did was take a decisive response that makes clear what President Trump has said for months and months and months, which is that we will not stand for the Islamic Republic of Iran to take actions that put American men and women in jeopardy. We will always honor that commitment to take decisive action when that takes place. And we continue to demand that the Islamic Republic of Iran act in a way that is consistent with what I laid out back in May of 2018 for what it is that we expect Iran to do so that it can rejoin the community of nations. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Secretary of Defense.
Thank you. As we reported earlier today, the Department of Defense took offensive actions in defense of our personnel and interests in Iraq by launching F-15 Strike Eagles against five targets associated with Kataib Hezbollah, which is an Iranian-sponsored Shiite militia group. The targets we attacked included three targets in western Iraq and two targets in eastern Syria that were either command and control facilities or weapons caches for Kataib Hezbollah. The strikes were successful. The pilots and aircraft returned back to base safely. I would add that in our discussion today with the President, we discussed with him other options that are available. And I would note also that we will take additional actions as necessary to ensure that we act in our own self-defense and we deter further bad behavior from militia groups or from Iran. Thank you.
Middle Eastern research fellow Corey Peterson-Smith of the Institute for Policy Studies says the weekend attacks against the Iranian-backed militia opens a new chapter in the escalating conflict between the U.S. and Iran.
This is extremely dangerous for a number of reasons. One is that the United States is framing this as retaliation for an attack on a U.S. military contractor carried out by an Iranian-backed armed force. But one question that remains is, why are U.S. forces still active in Iraq when two presidents ago they said that the U.S. is actually withdrawing from Iraq? Contrary to what Obama said about pulling out of Iraq and contrary to what Trump says about ending the U.S.'s endless wars, actually the U.S. is further entangling itself in wars in the Middle East. And that's obviously bad for this country, but more importantly, devastating for the region. I mean, Iraq has had U.S. troops since 2003. it's a very dangerous escalating situation going into 2020.
What exactly is the relationship between the United States and Iraq?
It's a really good question, because the idea was that the United States would invade, that the invasion would be welcomed, and that the U.S. would build a U.S.-friendly regime in Iraq, and so the U.S. wouldn't have to maintain a presence. In practice, what's happened is after the U.S. invasion, which was devastating, which did not involve Iraqis welcoming the United States, of course, but just involved the United States really shattering Iraqi society, the government that they left behind, and really the economy that they left behind, the whole Iraqi politics and society, they really promoted this corrupt system that now Iraqis have been revolting against, actually, for months. There's been this massive nationwide uprising against the system that the United States established after the invasion. And so to prop up that system, which very obviously is unpopular, the United States has given Iraq billions in aid, in addition to its own direct U.S. military operations, like those that Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher, who committed war crimes, just was acquitted for. You know, that's the kind of thing that the U.S. was doing in Iraq with its own troops. But the U.S. is also giving Iraq billions in aid to build up its own military and police forces. The result has just been a disaster for Iraqis, which is why they're in the streets to this day. But it's also the case that the U.S. hasn't left. And these latest U.S. operations just show that there's no plan to leave, actually, that they're planning on staying and becoming further entrenched in this ongoing conflict with Iran that is further engulfing the whole region.
If an Iraqi president were to say, well, we're a sovereign country as of January 10th, all Americans, please leave. We're revoking your visas. Close up your bases and go. Would people just laugh in their face?
The fact is, Iraqi politicians who are in power at the moment, they're operating with forces that have basically been funded by the United States. So on one hand, the U.S. has laid the basis for a certain dependency on an ongoing U.S. commitment and presence in Iraq. And at the same time, of course, Iran has actually emerged as a really powerful player in terms of shaping Iraqi politics, which, of course, is the U.S.'s main adversary in the Middle East. So I think therein lies the really complicated situation. The U.S. doesn't take kindly, of course, to any country telling it that it has to leave. And the U.S. is entangled in that place. And unfortunately, Iraqi politics and the Iraqi elite is a certain entanglement with U.S. empire as well.
So what is Iran doing there at the same time?
Unfortunately, for people throughout the Middle East, Iran and the United States are in this contest for which kind of power will orient the politics of the region. Will they have an orientation toward Washington and its various allies in Israel and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere? Or will it be toward Tehran? And so Iran is trying to promote its own power. Not only does Iran wield great political influence in Iraq, but also economic influence and so on. And that's really what Iran is trying to promote. But the fact is that the whole political system that has been produced through a combination of actions by the United States and Iran and Iraqi elites, all of that has really been challenged by this massive nationwide uprising, because there's such disgust by the Iraqi population by and large. And that's cutting across the various divisions that have gotten in the way of unity in the past.
Now we've gotten to the situation where we open the door to this. The U.S. is striking back at groups associated with Iran, and Iran is allegedly striking, or groups associated with Iran is striking at U.S. forces. What's happening?
Right.
Where does this go from here?
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the United States really has a plan to end that kind of. The latest attack on U.S. forces could have been a sign, one of countless signs, that the U.S. should withdraw from Iraq completely, the U.S. should never have invaded Iraq, and so on. But instead of reading the sign that way, instead of saying, okay, this really points out why the U.S. should leave, by carrying out this attack in response, of course, the U.S. is further entrenching its presence in Iraq. And so at the moment, it doesn't look like they have any plan to withdraw, actually. I mean, and that's true, unfortunately, with all of the various countries where the U.S. is carrying out its military operations. That's true in Afghanistan, where negotiations are constantly kind of breaking down with the Taliban. That's true in Somalia. That's true in any number of countries. Whatever Trump says rhetorically about ending the endless wars, the fact is they're just digging deeper and they don't seem to have any kind of way out.
Yeah, anything you like to add?
I don't want to leave on that dire note.
Good.
And so please, I do want to, right. I just want to point out that uprising in Iraq, I think, is so significant. And it's among various uprisings and protest waves throughout the region, from Lebanon to inside of Iran and Syria in an ongoing way. These various forces by different movements and struggles throughout the region, these are, I think, the hope, because they point to self-determination. They point to the people who live in this region deciding for themselves what it will look like, and doing so through popular mobilization and protests. If we're just looking at what's happening in Washington, I don't see any conversations there about actually ending these wars. So that's not where the hope lies. The hope lies in the popular protests that is emerging throughout the region, which is really part of the popular protest emerging all around the world. And so I hope that 2020 brings us much more of that.
Middle East Research Fellow Corey Peterson-Smith of the Institute for Policy Studies. Meanwhile, Eric Prince, a major Republican donor and founder of controversial security firm Blackwater, has been referred to the U.S. Department of Treasury, the Treasury Department, for possible sanctions violations leading tied to his recent trip to Venezuela for a meeting with the top aide of President Nicolas Maduro. That's according to senior U.S. officials. There's no indication that Prince, whose sister is Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, will be sanctioned for the meeting last month in Caracas with Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez. Little has been revealed about Prince's surprise trip to Caracas last month, but his presence in Venezuela prompted questions about a possible secret back channel to Maduro on behalf of the Trump administration. That's something the State Department has strenuously denied. It also marks a reversal for Prince, who was thought to have been pitching a plan to form a mercenary army to topple Maduro. Sources say Prince, a former Navy SEAL, continues to support the Trump administration's goal of removing Maduro. Prince soared to notoriety after Blackwater employees in 2007 shot and killed Iraqi civilians in Baghdad's Nisour Square during the Iraq War. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will visit Ukraine this week, marking his first trip to the country at the heart of President Donald Trump's impeachment. As the Senate weighs options for a trial, Pompeo will depart Thursday on a five-nation tour of Europe and Central Asia. Ukraine will be the first stop on the trip. Trump's impeachment on charges of abuse of office and obstruction of Congress hinges on his policy toward Ukraine. Witnesses told House investigators that Trump wanted Ukraine to announce an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden's son in return for releasing critical military aid to Iran. And closer to home, authorities say a man charged with federal hate crimes Monday in a bloody attack on a Hanukkah celebration had handwritten journals containing anti-Semitic references and had recently used his phone to look up information on Hitler and the location of synagogues. Grafton Thomas, 37, was held without bail after appearing in federal court in White Plains on five counts of obstructing the free exercise of religious beliefs by attempting to kill with a dangerous weapon. Five people were stabbed and slashed in the Saturday attack north of New York City. The stabbings on the seventh night of Hanukkah came amid a series of violent attacks targeting Jews in the region that have led to increased security, particularly around religious gatherings. Today, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams met with community leaders to present a plan for bridging what he says is a cultural gap. Adams began by describing the recent increase in racist and anti-Semitic attacks in Brooklyn and the region.
Get the cases. At the heart of the cases that we are seeing across the city, the numbers speak for themselves. Since last Thursday, there were 183 anti-Semitic hate crimes in the city of New York, a 22% increase from last year. And really, the number is even more impactful because it's almost a 39% since 2016. Hate crimes are increasing, but clearly the Jewish community is receiving the brunt of these attacks. And people have often stated, well, is it simply zeroing in on the Hasidic community? I say no to that. I say the Hasidic community is representative of Judaism, and I believe people are not only attacking the individuals, but they're attacking the symbol. And as a person of color that knows the history of being targeted, if I was a Jewish resident of this city right now, I too would be alarmed. It is alarming what we're seeing. What we're seeing, some of the assaults, some of the rocks thrown at buildings, the swastikas, what we saw in Muncie, what we saw in New Jersey, the combination of these attacks are giving a real chilling effect to the community at large, from Williamsburg to Borough Park to Crown Heights to Muncie to Union City. It is sending the same message that hate has become pervasive in our city and in the tri-state area, and we want to do all that's possible to stop it. Hate is a virus, and it will continue to spread at a rapid pace if we don't address it at its heart and at its source.
And Rabbi Abe Friedman described the fear growing in the Jewish community in the wake of the attacks.
I remember when I was a little child at the Hanukkah holiday, my grandfather told me stories about Nazi Germany. Who would ever imagine 25 years later, I'll have to explain to my little 11-year-old why people hate. As I lighted the menorah last night, I didn't have the answers for my son when he was asking me, "Daddy, what's going on? Why do people hate us? What is happening?" As a community leader, first, I'm extremely thankful for the borough president and the congressman for their leading role in speaking out when the community hurts. Like the borough president always says, if someone hates against one, it hates against all. As you saw in the church yesterday, I just wanted to say how my heart breaks when I visited the family of the Ferns family in Jersey City just last week. A 7-year-old girl is still asking me, when is my mom coming home? When is my mom coming home? And I didn't have the answers. And now the community is grieving and mourning still in Jersey City, now dealing with another tragedy in Muncie, New York. We all have to come together. This is a 9/11 in our community. We can't continue like this. We're a community of love and peace. We want to live close to our neighbors. Like the district leader says, we're just one community, one family, and we're asking and we encourage everybody to live together in peace and love and harmony. And I thank again the congressman and the borough president for the amazing leadership. Thank you so much.
We open to any questions at this time, if there are any. Yes, sir.
And Jeffrey Davis, a Brooklyn political leader whose brother was a council member shot and killed in City Hall in 2003, has been involved in bringing groups together, most recently after a shooting at Juve, the festival leading up to the Caribbean Day Parade. Davis says the institutions necessary for bringing peace already exist in Brooklyn.
These institutions are in a 5-block radius from one another. You can go to the Jewish Children Museum and learn about the Jewish culture, the historic Jewish culture. You can go down to Carlos Lazama, Clacky, home, and learn about the history of the Caribbean culture, the carnival, and how that began. You can go down to the Brooklyn Children Museum. This is all in 4-block radius. And learn from the first of its kind, Brooklyn Children Museum. And then you can come down to the James E. Davis Multicultural Museum of Peace and learn about the peace movement and the efforts that we've taken with the groundbreaking of the Bedford Union Armory, with the children's book, with the film, and so much more. You can learn about the history right there. That's the Crown Heights Cultural Hub. These are things that can be instituted as we continue to go forward. So I spoke to Rabbi Eli Cohen, and he said he's on board with all of this, and he says, thank you, Borough President Adams. Thank you, Pastor Noble, Gil. He said, thank you, Congressman, and thank you. thank you to everyone a part of this, and thank you to the media. But it breaks my heart when somebody gets hurt over hate, over jealousy, because I'm an experienced, my family member, over jealousy and hate. It breaks my heart for Muncie, what took place in Jersey City, and all across the nation, it breaks my heart. But rather than just sitting and moaning and crying, we take an active role to get involved and to engage with solution-oriented messages, with a solution-oriented conversation to do something about this, to make change. So I've dedicated my life to that. I stand with these fine young men who have dedicated their life to that. We've known each other for over 25 some odd years. I stand with these fine young men in grief sometimes, in the mourning, in pain, but I stand with them because we gotta continue to fight on. It doesn't just hurt the victim, but the families suffer.
Adams went on to describe his proposal for 100 dinners across Brooklyn.
Found that in our school system, in our yeshivas, in our private schools, young people were talking to young people across the globe, but they did not know people across the borough. When we visit schools such as Sunset Park and in Brownsville, you had young people who have not interacted with anyone outside of their ethnic group. That's alarming and that's troubling. And if you are not communicating with each other, you will never really understand each other. We announced several months ago an initiative that we're doing with the ADL on doing a No Place for Hate, a social program in our schools. The ADL doubled down on their funding. We also allocated funding. We thought it was important. This is providing a real curriculum for children between the ages in pre-K to 12-year-old, organizing structural instructions inside a classroom environment to teach young people how to look at bullying and also in other forms of hate that really have become pervasive in our school. Today we're announcing something that I think is important. We're announcing an initiative, we're giving it the name, the title, Breaking Bread and Building Bonds. The goal is to have each 10 person at the table come from a different ethnic group. So one table will have a person from Haiti, a person that's of Jewish faith, Sikh, Pakistani, Yemen, all different groups coming together, sitting around a table and sharing cultures, sharing understanding, explaining what is a kufi, what is a hijab, what is a yarmulke, what are different foods, what are some of the historical pains that the communities have gone through, what are some of the cultural issues that impact the community, and then there will be a follow-up. After the dinner, they will go and visit each other's environment. They will visit the Schomburg Center in Harlem. They will visit a mosque, a synagogue, a Sikh temple. They will learn from each other and in the process become ambassadors to talk about on the ground what is happening and how we must live together.
And Congressman Hakeem Jeffries told about his experiences in a diverse district and went on to discuss the need for national leadership from the White House.
Well, it's a moment that requires leadership at every single level. And I certainly think that we're hopeful that we'll see moral leadership coming from every single office and certainly the highest office in the land moving forward. The congressional delegation will be speaking on this issue a little further later on in the week. But I will say that we have worked as hard as we can as a delegation to try to secure additional funding, both to deal with incidents of domestic violence, or should I say domestic terrorism, as well as funding to allow houses of worship and synagogues and shuls and yeshivas and churches to secure the funding necessary in an increasingly volatile environment. So, in the midst of the tragedy, we're still expressing our condolences and support for those who are grieving in Jersey City, those who are dealing with the trauma of the attack in Muncie. So I think all of us should put politics aside, and hopefully the President of the United States will do that as well. Well, we've been dealing, you know, at the leadership level, and I'm not sure what the status is of the conversations between Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi at this point. He certainly spends a lot of time tweeting about her. I do think that, again, leadership is required at this moment, and hopefully we'll see that from the President of the United States.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, responding to a suggestion that the governor call in the National Guard, Adams said that's not the way to go.
We have one of the best police departments in the country, if not on the globe. I believe our hate crime unit is doing an amazing job, the apprehensions, and I think we need to continue to support and make sure they have the resources. I understand the concern that the electeds have raised in their community, and I respect that, but I believe that having a military force without the proper training can actually exacerbate the problem and not assist the problem. We're not going to be able to police ourselves out of this problem. It's going to take a combination of smart laws, smart law enforcement tactics, but we have to go to the root of the problem, and that root lies in our inability to communicate, respect, and understand each other.
Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. And that's some of the news for Monday, December 30th, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Ken Gale. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.